my personal experience with my family and their illnesses and navigating chronic disease and being a health advocate and support for them is really where the fundamental pieces of public health started for me. I knew how it changed my life and the trajectory of my life. I wouldn't be here in many ways had it not been for some of those guidance and resources and tools that I had very early on when we moved to the United States. And then as I went on in my career, my ability to give back and have a fulfilling role in which I then support people in signing up for food stamps or in getting Medicaid, because that's what my family was accessing when I first moved to the United States, and do that for now communities and people and help them understand information, answer questions, and be a trusted, reliable resource. To be an avenue now to help people improve their quality of life is fulfilling, and I'm fortunate to work with the communities and the people that I do now to make sure that they also have the tools and resources to live high quality lives.
That was today's guest, Shanaz Hussain. Hello and welcome everybody to Making Public Health Personal. This podcast is brought to you by the CUNY Graduate School of Public Health and Health Policy in New York City. I'm your host, Laura Mioli Farragon. Thanks for listening. Today's guest is Shanaz Hussain, a graduate of the Master's in Health Communication for Social Change program at CUNY SPH. She's also a certified community health education specialist with almost 10 years of experience in public health, focusing on communication, social determinants of health, health disparity, health equity, and social justice. Currently, she's the director of the Health Information Tool for Empowerment, a health and social service referral tool operated by the Greater New York Hospital Association. In today's episode, we'll discuss everything from her career journey, her journey here to the United States, overcoming healthcare barriers, and advice for determining if online public health content is accurate. Shanaz, thank you for joining.
Thanks for having me.
So you were born in the Republic of Trinidad and Tobago. What brought you to New York?
So I moved to the United States when I was 8 with my family, my younger sister and my parents. And as many people do in their journey to the United States, the reason really was to seek a better life for ourselves. And first and foremost, my family's emphasis on education really is one of the main reasons we moved to the United States. So the opportunity to study in the United States, work, and ultimately set down our roots for our future is what brought us here.
And what inspired you to study public health?
It's really the combination of my roots of being from the Caribbean in combination with my immigrant experience to the United States. Public health has always been something that is ingrained in my day-to-day life and culturally as part of my life. In the Caribbean, health and access to healthcare and resources was always, just like I mentioned with education, an instrumental piece of people's lives. And there was often a very heavy focus on health as it relates to food. And so because food is such a big part of culture, food was often grown. There was more local farming and less processed foods and less really what we now consider Western influences in some of the foods and food choices. But food and culture was the foundations for health for me, as well as access to being from a country with universal healthcare system, having access to resources and vaccinations and other instrumental pillars of health is really what set the foundation for my general interest in health and healthcare. But then my journey to the United States really shaped that as well. And this grand scheme, living in the United States, and it really a broader spectrum than just the individual health. And really, this is where the emphasis of the public and more community health was at play. And so public health here expanded for me beyond just food and culture and day-to-day healthcare needs, and more broadly into some other spaces related to environment and structural setups and policy, which is a huge component of healthcare in the United States, as well as advocacy, which is something that is, of course, a protected right in the United States, the ability to voice your opinion and concerns. So public health went from being a very individualized experience or individual or more so even to my close family and more of a really broad coveted spectrum in the U.S.
And how old were you when you came to the U.S.?
I was 8 years old. So when I started my education in the U.S. I started in fourth grade.
You were a kid back then, so your experience was different. But how do you see it having evolved? Did it get better in your perspective or worse?
That's a really great question. I think although I was young when I moved to the States, I was in a position as also the eldest daughter where I helped my parents navigate a lot of the system. So I am very aware of some of the changes that have taken place over time. Healthcare on one aspect has definitely become more accessible to folks that are undocumented and maybe working towards citizenship or some sort of legal status. For example, there's a public hospital system where you can't be turned away for services. You can access services regardless of immigration status, ability to pay, income, et cetera. At the time when I first moved here, that was something that was more accessible to children and women and not more broadly to families. And now it is something that is prioritized. Mm-hmm. As far as social services, which is another really key aspect of public health and speaks more to social determinants of health and social needs, I would say the resources are abundant now. Mm-hmm. And if anything, they are more clearly communicated and shared. So at the time, I think it was very difficult to understand there are community-based organizations that are out there to help you. As opposed to now, I feel like it is, maybe there's a bias because I do work in the space, but I will say that there is more communication and promotion of free services like SNAP benefits, food stamps assistance, Medicaid, and other resources, whether it's related to housing or the word free and free services and free resources, I feel like wasn't thrown around as much as it is now. Like it's something that is so prevalent. And again, this may also be because we do live in New York City, which is a very resource-rich city as far as its ability to serve its residents, although I know there are challenges there. But compared to other parts of the United States, New York City is still a great leader and example of how social benefits and public assistance can uplift families and individuals.
Tell me about your current job at the Greater New York Hospital Association.
Sure. I am the director of the Health Information Tool for Empowerment, otherwise known as HITESITE, which is a online resource directory. It is really meant to be a comprehensive guide that lists health and social services that are available in New York City, Long Island, and Westchester. These services include low free cost or services that accept Medicaid or Medicare. So it's a very specific population and often an underserved population, folks that really need these types of services. So it lists everything from food assistance programs to education, housing placement services, eviction prevention services, immigration services, legal supports and services. Like I mentioned, New York City is so abundantly rich, but in some ways we do a great job at communicating what's available. And then in other instances, for many folks who may not have access, we may not do a clear and concise job of it. So HITESITE hopes to pull together all of those services and resources into one website that people can go on to, whether they work in the professional setting and they're looking to help a client or patient, or they're the 8-year-old me who's getting online trying to help their family find a food pantry or find a service near them.
Yeah.
Because oftentimes, again, I'm thinking through like accessibility and how people can mm-hmm. get this information. An older senior or someone who's maybe not tech savvy, but there's avenues in which the site hopes to be easy to access, free, available on a computer, mobile device, tablet, anything with internet, and hopes to provide the information. The really amazing thing that I'm incredibly grateful for and our team is that the site is updated frequently. So the information is kept current, accurate, up to date. So really in an effort to limit confusion and the unfortunate event if someone visits a page, calls an organization, they find out the organization's closed. That does a disservice to communities. So our real effort is to make sure we have over 6,000 resources. We actively update them and maintain relationships with the organizations that are listed in the directory as well.
So this health information tool for empowerment, that you created is a really great resource for people to find these public health resources. And this is fully vetted by experts like you. But that's not always the case when people might be searching for information online, especially during the pandemic. And then now there's a lot of misinformation and disinformation on the internet. And not everybody knows how to verify what they're looking at online. Why is it so important to have factual, accurate information on the internet? And how can people who aren't public health experts determine if what they're looking at online is real or not?
That's a great question. And you're right. We saw some of the consequences of misinformation over the last couple of years with the rise of technology and social media and our connectedness over the internet. The first piece of your question is that it is so important to have accurate information that is backed by whether it's research or reputable resources that have, if not a researcher or a publication come out, but organizations that have done this work for decades and have the knowledge and experience to speak to it. It actually is a matter of a couple of things related to what we saw over the last couple of years, right? Literally life or death situations in which a vaccine can really change the course of an individual's life, right? Prevent them from getting an illness or a disease that ultimately can lead to poor qualities of life or ultimately their demise. So those are some of the consequences of misinformation. And there's the work that you and I do where we are able to receive and understand and process data because we look at it every day and we have context and knowledge in which that data is generated in. But more so, the information that is presented also needs to be digestible and plain language enough that folks can understand what is being discussed. And that's often the challenge. And even personally, some of my drawbacks from what we saw early in the pandemic, we had multiple agencies sending different messages and weren't aligned and communicating.
Yeah.
And as someone who works in this space, but also someone who is just obviously a part of the general public as well, if I found that very confusing, I couldn't imagine what most people were also experiencing.
Yeah.
So I think there's a real importance on not only accurate information that is backed by data and science and research, but also consistent messaging in which you can clearly communicate and find the appropriate avenues in which to reach the audience that you're attempting to reach. And understanding who your audience is another key component of the messaging. As far as discerning reliable resources, I encourage everyone to view information from a lens of curiosity and asking questions and being open to looking at all the different resources or information that's available to them before then thinking as an individual, okay, this is my value and this is what's important to me. This is how this information influences my life and what I value in my life, and then take another step to then make a decision. Focusing on staying away from blogs and resources that are heavily more opinionated resources, the I believes, I think, views in which you are maybe steered or limited into thinking one way, but more so challenging those views and also questioning, okay, why is it that this is being recommended? Historically, how has this been something that we've seen? How have we seen this probably in the past? How is it related to what's going on now? And then even more broadly, not everyone may have the ability to do that, but then turning to resources like the work that my organization does or trusted community-based organizations who have staff who are trained this work and know how to answer your questions. The general public should feel free to ask their doctors, ask anyone that they're interacting with what I would encourage the comfort and hope that there is no silly question, you know, just ask and see and have a conversation really about it. A lot of what we saw during the pandemic, information sharing was from friends and neighbors and colleagues and peers, right? And so as much as I want to encourage people to trust reliable websites and resources, I also think what goes on in smaller circles and communities is really important to make sure that we're injecting information there. And that's really being done through organizations and people that work in communities as well.
Yeah, and you mentioned about websites stating opinions. And if it's a more traditional news source like Washington Post, New York Times, one of those newspapers, they will write at the top if it's an opinion piece or not. They will always label it that way. But I think we've gotten away from it being so obvious when something is an opinion and people are just blatantly saying, like, this is a fact and with no information to back it up. And so something I learned in grad school was how to write papers where you're, every sentence that you're stating something has to have a source behind it. You can't just say, this is a fact and then have no source. And so I think that's a good lesson for all content creators and people who are looking for content to read something with a skeptical eye and say, if someone is saying that this is a fact, this one sentence, but where is this information? If you just want to limit yourself to the internet, there's plenty out there, but just Googling and seeing, is it verified from a source? Is it from a trusted piece of research or researcher? Or is it just someone saying something that anybody could put up a website, anybody could write an article online? And the people who are more skilled at graphic design, you know, it will look more professional than something that might be from a local organization that might not have that technical skill. So it is still difficult to navigate, but I think what you say about the local organizations and speaking to your doctor, those are people we know for sure 100% are going to be giving you that real information.
If you dream of making a difference in the world, a public health degree or certificate can give you the tools to do just that. The City University of New York's Graduate School of Public Health and Health Policy equips public health professionals to advance not only a healthier New York City, but a healthier world for us all. We want you to join us in our mission. Visit sph.cuny.edu to learn more about our programs. No matter where you are in your career, CUNY SPH offers a broad range of degree and certificate programs to not only help you advance in your career, but to have a real impact on the world. Public health professionals are needed now and more than ever. Join us. Visit sph.cuny.edu to learn more.
Your role has a lot of technology and web design incorporated. But you studied public health. So what role does technology play in healthcare and public health?
Yes. So interestingly enough, I work very closely and I definitely want to give credit to my amazing IT and web design and programming colleagues because their expertise is the shell that I work out of. My area and the way that my work in public health overlaps here is I'm the content expert as far as the resources and information that we're generating. And I work in collaboration with my programming and web design colleagues to do so. So this is really a great way of highlighting the ways that multi-sectors can work together here to make sure that the goals are ultimately being met, which is to provide up-to-date, accurate information to people. And so that's really where my work sits. It's being the public health expert, right? So vetting the information that is in its very bare bones and then saying, okay, this is accurate. This isn't accurate. We need to have a resource, some sort of citation for this. This is incorrect. This is what the policy says. And really making sure that the content is its best, its highest quality before it's given to our team to then make sure it's available to people. And more broadly, technology has encompassed every piece of our life. And more so specifically with health, healthcare, public health, technology now is playing a role in which it's at all levels. So it's at the patient level where you can have a telehealth visit from your home. You can have virtual therapy. You can view your patient portal on your phone. You have all this information right at your hands and your fingertips. You can fill prescriptions online. And there's just all of this that was previously not accessible, and you had to maybe physically go to a doctor's office or call a doctor's office. Now you can access healthcare services without even leaving your home. And then at the organization, community-based organization level, it is a tool that actually organizations are using to build capacity, right? So whether they have challenges regarding workforce or information sharing or case management, patient referrals, things like that, they are utilizing tools in ways that provide more comprehensive care for their patients and clients, making sure that people are receiving text messages or reminders and different ways to say, this is how we're going to maintain our relationship and maintain our systems of care. So technology is right now, in healthcare in particular, it's a space that is being explored further. Technology is a tool that we know will improve healthcare. But at the same time, there's also a lot of concerns around technology and healthcare as it relates to privacy, patient information, like we're mentioning, misinformation, and really the dissemination of information that's incorrect and using a medical or clinical disguise to say in which that something is reliable and is a vetted resource. So we've seen at the provider clinical organization level, technology embedded there way earlier than we have at the patient or at the individual level. And that's where now technology and healthcare is trying to bridge the gap so that that same level of transparency, connectedness, access is available at the patient level. So then people can make the best decisions for themselves related to their healthcare. So that's really where healthcare is going. And even more broadly, we're seeing all these headlines about artificial intelligence, AI, and the role of AI in healthcare. And that also opens up a whole new avenue of challenges, right? There are possibly consequences and challenges of AI with medical biases, things that unfortunately we already see in the healthcare setting that we have to now figure out, how does AI now fit into healthcare? Does it fit in? How? And if so, how? And how do we make sure that it's beneficial and not as harmful? So there's so much more that we need to learn. But in my work on Hindsight, our goal is to, at the most fundamental level, be a source of information and provide information in which people can then take and decide their next course of action in tangent with their doctors, their families. So I'm optimistic about technology and healthcare, but I also know that there will be many challenges that we're also going to see arise.
So when you were studying for your master's at SBH or even your undergraduate degree, what did you expect you would be doing career-wise post-graduation?
I did not expect I'd be doing this. I didn't think I would be in a healthcare, technology, social care sort of area. To be honest, at the undergraduate level, my love for food and culture put me on a nutritionist, registered dietitian sort of track. And so I anticipated going into working in that space and being a registered dietitian until I found public health. And public health for me opened up more venues in which I could have work that was, to me, improving quality of life that was outside of just people's diets or lifestyle or behavioral changes related to food, exercise, or movement. And that's really why I did pivot into public health in my undergraduate degree track and then went on to do a master's at CUNY SPH in public health as well. And I think I was very fortunate to just know right off the bat that public health was the space I wanted to be in, primarily because there is so much to do in public health. There are so many subgroups within the space that I think anyone who is even considering it could find a space that they would find the right fit in one of the subgroups within the category.
So what's the most important lesson that you learned at CUNY SPH that you still use today?
There's so much. CUNY SPH provided me the opportunity and encouraged me to look at everything through a social justice lens, the opportunity to understand the communities in which we serve in New York City, the opportunity to understand and fully break down individuals' behaviors and why people behave the way they do. Not because they choose to be unhealthy, not because they choose to live in poverty. Yeah. People don't choose those things, but in which to understand the circumstances in which they exist within different systemic structures or environmental structures. It's really a eye-opening, refreshing, and as we emphasize in public health, an equitable lens to look at everything through. And it really influences your role as a practitioner when you're working with populations. It allows you to think beyond you and your training and step into individual lives and say, what is going on in that person's life? Or quite frankly, just to ask them, like, what is happening that you're not making your doctor's appointment? Is there something that you need? Do you need transportation, childcare? The school really embedded that in all of the programs, regardless of which concentration you study in. It's a real emphasis of the school, and I commend the school for really putting that as a part of the curriculum. And it's made me a better person, but also a better public health practitioner.
So you speak about equity for people who aren't familiar, because we think equality, but equity is not equality. How would you define equity in the context of public health? And how do you contribute to that in your work?
Yeah, that's a great question. Equality is the way that in public health we define it would be equal access to all. That's a baseline definition in this space, meaning everyone has equal access. Equity is another added layer where it is access to all, which is tailored based on individual circumstances, environment, needs. Mm-hmm. So equality in this case, for lack of a better word, ignores the circumstances in which people live, work, operate.
Yeah, their starting point.
Of course. Mm-hmm. And so equity hopes to make sure that individuals receive not just baseline resources and services, but are given additional support and services in whatever space they need, whether that be maybe they have a physical disability and they need resources to navigate that, whether there's a language or cultural competency gap that needs to be filled and resources are needed there. But it's really focused on the individual, the population, the community, and what their needs are beyond the baseline approach. And in my work running a website, we focus on so many different populations. So we have services tailored to seniors listed on there, but then the website needs to be accessible for someone who may not be technologically savvy. So we have printed materials that we're also provide. We have materials that are translated if someone doesn't speak English. Website itself can be translated into numerous languages. There is various accessibility components to make sure the font size and the colors, and again, these are credits to my web design colleagues, but these are all things that we think about when we put information on our website, and also the terminology in which we're using. So we're not using complex medical terminology. We're writing out, if we have cardiology, we're listing in parentheses, heart, like using terminology and language that is familiar, that people can understand and digest, are all ways in which we operate from an equity lens.
Yeah, because an 8-year-old could be looking up that information for their parents.
Absolutely. Yes. And I remember how challenging that was for me. And to be honest, even as an adult now, right, sometimes I'm looking for something and I'm just in the weeds of information and I can't find what I want. So we hope that the site can just streamline all of that for people.
Great. And as we wind down, what advice do you have for others interested in a career in public health?
I would encourage any and everyone to come over to the site of public health, even if you are, let's say you've already started in your career and you're thinking about making a career change. There is enough space and there is so much space in public health for you. Public health needs the lenses and the perspectives of people from all sectors, right? Maybe you have a marketing background. Maybe you've worked in some other avenue, whether it's biological sciences. There is space in public health for you because your skills can be applied across the board here. When I think about marketing, I think directly to my degree and what I'm focused on. There's really endless amounts of opportunity. And I also think any issue or space in which you have an interest in, I could almost certainly find a way how it connects back to public health. Whether you are concerned about institutional racism, right? That is something, racism is a public health issue. If you're concerned about gun violence, is a public health issue. If you are interested in urban development. That is a huge space in public health where we're thinking about infrastructure and parks and sidewalks and how people navigate their communities.
Yeah,
I can go on and on. Yeah. Climate change. If climate change is something that really upsets you and you have this passion and this fire burning in you, climate change is a public health issue and has public health implications as we're seeing more and more these days, unfortunately. So I would strongly encourage you to, even if you're not sure how your work may connect or your interest may connect, if you're just starting out and you're like, these are the things that upset me that I'd like to make a difference with. We need you. We need that passion and that enthusiasm. Think through what those interests are and do some research and reach out to folks at CUNY SPH if you're looking into a master's program. Ask questions, and I'm almost certain that you will figure out if public health is right for you. But at the surface level, like I mentioned, I think there is so much opportunity. And similarly to my journey, I didn't originally start in public health. It wasn't something that I just knew, like, this is what I wanted. But I found it through another avenue. And then once I found it, I've never left it. So I would, yeah, definitely encourage people to consider it as a career path. And I'm always happy to talk to people that are considering CUNY SPH as well for their future studies.
Thanks again, Shanaz, for being a guest. And thank you for listening to Making Public Health Personal, presented by the CUNY Graduate School of Public Health and Health Policy in New York City. You can now share, like, and subscribe to our show everywhere podcasts are heard and on our YouTube channel. To find out more about our school and our programs, you can visit sph.cuny.edu or connect with us on social media. This is your host, Laura Mioli-Ferragon, signing off. And while public health has a global impact, that doesn't mean we can't make it personal.